have to really escalate the noise we make so that we'll be heard.
Welcome to Gay USA. I'm Andy Hump.
And I'm Ann Northrup.
And our guest at the top of the show is Sarah Schulman on her epic and highly praised new book, Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993.
I'm very excited about talking to Sarah. Meanwhile, not so excited about the fact that the Federal Equality Act is being pronounced just about dead, barring a miracle, in Washington, D.C.
But we are excited about the Nashville district attorney who said he won't enforce Tennessee's newest anti-transgender law.
Well, I can keep this theme rolling. Not excited about 60 Minutes on Sunday, which hit the already besieged transgender community with a piece that will give ammunition to their oppressors.
Governor Cuomo has just nominated another gay man to New York's highest court
to replace Paul Feinman, who died. And activists and families in Massachusetts are challenging the authorities there, who say that a lesbian teen, Michaela Miller, took her own life. But did she?
We mourn the deaths of two more trans victims of violence, as well as AIDS activist and museum big, Terry Riley, and lesbian singer and activist, Alex Dobkin.
And we also mourn a beloved gay performer in Brazil who lost his life to COVID.
Illinois is the second state to pass HIV decriminalization legislation.
And Lil Nas X performed what has to be the gayest number in Saturday Night Live history.
And before we move into the interview, I just want to say, if you are watching Gay USA on YouTube, please take a second to subscribe so you will be notified each time we upload a new show. And please hit the like button to help us reach more viewers on YouTube. I thank you, and our associate producer, Bill Ballman, thanks you.
And now we want to welcome in Sarah Schulman, an old friend and colleague of both of ours. We're thrilled to have her today. She is the author of this fantastic new book, Let the Record Show, A Political History of ACT UP New York, 1987 to 1993. It is a magnificent achievement of almost 700 pages. But before we get into the interview, oh, have you got the hardcover?
Yeah.
I've got the galleys in paperback. Before we get into that, and to set the tone for the interview, we want to show you something else, because Sarah and her colleague Jim Hubbard did a film, United in Anger, that is a terrific portrayal of ACT UP in those years. And so we want to show you a couple of minutes of that, the trailer for United in Anger.
Living in New York at that time was like crazy, because people are getting sick every day. 3, 4, 5, 6 people that you hear about being sick.
We were very scared that the Reagan administration was going to put people with AIDS in internment camps. And I think that we came close to that in this country.
How deeply are Americans worried about AIDS? A Los Angeles Times poll found that 50% of Americans favor quarantine for AIDS victims. 15% said AIDS victims should be tattooed.
It was about people in power not caring about the lives of people who didn't have power.
Kramer delivered a fiery speech, and I remember he asked like half of the audience to stand up, and he said, "You're all going to be dead in 6 months. Now what are we going to do about it?"
To unleash power, we are a diverse, nonpartisan group of individuals united in anger and committed to direct action to end the AIDS crisis.
Release those drugs! Release those drugs!
When we're ACT
activist. When we really act up, we have a big impact, and we get what we're demanding, and when we're silent, we don't.
We'll never be silent again. Act up. We'll never be silent again. Act up.
Where I really got a sense of community.
I mean, I got the feeling then that people felt that lives depended on them.
Healthcare is the right! Healthcare is the right!
Act up! Fight back! Fight it!
These drug companies are profiteering on our lives, and that we cannot accept that anymore.
A fantastic film. I can't see that material often enough. So give me a second to do this introduction. So Sarah is an author of what, about 20 books, fiction, nonfiction, plays, has made documentaries. She is the distinguished professor of humanities at the College of Staten Island, co-founder of the Mix New York LGBT Experimental Film and Video Festival, and co-founder and co-director with Jim Hubbard of the ACT UP Oral History Project. And she's only 20 years old.
62, yeah.
But 20 years ago, you created this thing called the ACT UP Oral History Project. I plead guilty to being a skeptic. I remember the meeting at NYU that you convened to talk about doing this. And I sat there in my cynical way and said, oh, no one cares about this stuff. No one will ever read it. But you, nonetheless, you went on to do 188 interviews with members of ACT UP New York, and a fantastic treasure trove. I refer people to it all the time because it is so rich and so important. But nonetheless, you thought people were not making full use of that. And so you sat down to write this book. So tell us about the creation of this book.
Well, so to start with, I've been covering AIDS since about 82. I was a City Hall reporter for the New York Native, and the story at the time was that there was no gay rights bill. Thanks to Andy Hum and the Coalition for Lesbian and Gay Rights, we did get a gay rights bill in 1986, but at the time we did not, and that meant that people could be fired from their jobs, kicked out of apartments, or denied public accommodation like restaurants and hotels, something that people do not remember now. Anyway, at that point, in 1981, science started to recognize the pattern that became known as AIDS, even though we now realize that it existed probably since the 1940s in the United States. So there I was, girl reporter, and I started covering the stories. And it was very chaotic. You know, I did some research stories, pediatric AIDS, women with AIDS, homeless people with AIDS. But I also was assigned by the New York Native to cover the closing of the bathhouses, which is kind of crazy because women were not allowed in the bathhouses. But it shows you how chaotic everything was. Reporters were dying. Editors were dying. My editor at the Village Voice, Robert Massa, gave me my edit in his home while he was in his pajamas. He was too sick to go to work. So I covered AIDS for about 5 years before ACT UP was founded in 1987. Now, in those 5 years, 40,000 people died. The government did nothing. And all pharma really did was try to recycle some failed cancer drugs that they own the patents for. Then ACT UP was founded in 1987. I joined in July 87. And then 12 people left the organization. That was the split in 1992. And after that, it kind of dissipated. 96 is protease inhibitors. By the end of the 20th century, there was the internet revolution. And ACT UP was none of our material was digitized. So in 99 or 2000, if you searched ACT UP online, you couldn't find anything. And people who were writing about AIDS, which there weren't many, but they were using the New York Times as their major source, which we called the New York Crimes. So this was a crime. So in 2001, which was the 20th anniversary of the time that AIDS was identified. I was listening to the radio, and the guy said, oh, at first America had trouble with people with AIDS, but then they came around. And I thought, no, oh no, this is what the story's going to be. But when the truth is that, you know, thousands of people fought until the day they died to force this country to change against its will. So Jim and I decided that we would create some raw data that people could use. And we imagined that academics somehow would use this data to analyze it or whatever. So Urvashi Vaid, one of the great leaders of our movement, was at the Ford Foundation at the time, and she had a huge vision for this project, and she funded us. And we started interviewing surviving members of ACT UP New York. And in the subsequent 18 years, we interviewed 188 people. And our website, which is actuporalhistory.org, has had over 14 million hits. So we kept waiting for somebody to sort of analyze the materials. We knew how rich they were. But it wasn't happening. And what happened instead was this kind of false history started to emerge that focused on, you know, a handful of individuals. And it was very much in the, you know, John Wayne, the great white male hero who saves the world type of thing. And it wasn't accurate. And those individuals did do important things, but so did many other people. And they were able to do what they did because there was a large movement behind them that was not being documented, and it began to feel like a state of emergency. And we tried to find someone else to do the work, and we couldn't find anyone, and we decided I had to do it. So I spent about 3 years rereading the interviews that I had conducted and cohering tropes. And the first thing I realized when sitting down to write the book is that trying to make it chronological would have made it completely inaccurate, because so many things happen at the same time. And that's actually what made ACT UP be able to create a paradigm shift, was that it was a radical democracy. It was a big tent organization. There was a lot of stuff going on at the same time. People were allowed to be where they are at and to do what they needed to do in the milieu that they were attracted to. And so the simultaneity of response was part of ACT UP's strength.
And the beauty, one of the real beauties of the book for me, and, you know, even the New York Times reviewer said she read the whole 700 pages in one day. It took me two, but it zooms by because it is so readable and compelling. But the miracle of it for me is that you do go so deep with so many people. It's just amazingly detailed. And as I read it, I sort of thought to myself, is it only ACT UP people who are going to care about all this detail and all these people who we remember and know and all these actions, or is this going to be meaningful to a larger audience? It truly is miraculous, the detail you have in there.
Well, I focus on 140 people. I mean, I think it's the whole point of this book is not nostalgia. The point of this book is to help activists today get information about what strategies we used worked and which ones didn't. Because getting activist history is a very difficult thing to do. I remember when I was younger, I read a book by Taylor Branch called Parting the Waters. That was also Mammoth. And it was an analysis of civil rights strategy. And I found it incredibly illuminating, but I could never find anything like it since, you know. So I wanted people to realize that any kind of person can make change. Well, and that's one of the conclusions of the book.
Sort of the thesis of the book, of ACT UP, was people from all walks of life working together can change the world. You have a long list of the accomplishments of ACT UP. Draw people into this. Help them understand. What did ACT UP change?
Okay, so ACT UP was able to force the government to change the way it did research. So just for younger people, AIDS is a really terrible death. You really suffer. What AIDS is that you lose your immune system. And so you get these things that we called opportunistic infections, which means you can get dementia, you can go blind. Your leg nerves would swell up. You would waste away. You couldn't retain nutrition. And science was not focused on treating these infections. They were looking for one pill that you could take that would fix your AIDS, because that's where the largest market was, the largest market share. So ACT UP forced that change. And interestingly, that campaign, which was called Countdown 18 Months, was run by a 17-year-old named Garance Frankie Ruda. ACT UP forced the Food and Drug Administration to make drugs available before they had been fully approved, you know, on a compassionate basis. And this was called, and this was designed by Jim Igoe, who was one of the geniuses of ACT UP. But prior to ACT UP, he had been a playwright. He had no science or government background. ACT UP created needle exchange in New York City. People broke the law, had a trial, and won, and made needle exchange legal in New York. ACT UP ran a four-year campaign that forced the government to change its definition of AIDS so that symptoms that women got could be included, and so that women could get benefits and get access to experimental drugs, and so that drugs could be tested on women. And in some ways, this amazing victory, because you need to remember that in the 1980s, the entire government was white males. The media was white males. The private sector was white males. The art world was white males. That women with HIV and predominantly white lesbians in ACT UP, who had no one in the government or the power system that identified with them, was able to force this change. And, you know, it's very far-reaching, because today every woman with HIV in the world who takes a medication is taking something that was tested on women. And you can date that back to this victory. And also, I think, and this is a really big, important victory of ACT UP, it changed the way that people with AIDS and queer people saw themselves and were seen by the world. Prior to ACT UP, the only images of people with AIDS out there were emaciated, helpless people dying of wasting syndrome in their beds. And photographers like Donna Binder forced the media to change their image of who a person with AIDS was to people fighting for their lives. So that's an enormous amount of accomplishment.
And to bring people, into the present day, I think it's fair to say, isn't it, that we would not have the vaccines we just got were it not for what ACT UP changed.
How do you see that?
I'm talking about for the pandemic, but the fact that it changed the way the medical establishment worked and got things out there. It used to take forever. Then they developed fast tracking and all those kinds of things.
Although I want to say that ACT UPers like Peter Staley and David Barr are still at work, and they are trying to make sure that those vaccines can go global and not be held hostage to the profit margin of pharma, which is what happened to AIDS drugs.
Yes, the argument over breaking the patents and letting those drugs be available worldwide at affordable prices is still the fight we're having. And we had it over HIV drugs, and now we're having it over the vaccines. I am also impressed by the rigorous honesty in this book and your refusal to pull punches in a number of areas. You reveal something I had certainly not known, which was that some of the members of the Treatment and Data Committee who were living with HIV got faster access to some of the experimental drugs than other people in the group.
I don't personally say that. I quote other people saying that.
Okay.
Moises Augusto, this is a really interesting story, because there were a lot of Latinos in ACT UP, and they have not been historicized. And I have three chapters on Latinos in ACT UP. And so I hope the first chapter is on Puerto Ricans in ACT UP. Moises Augusto, who came from the island, when he first came to ACT UP, he was in the Latino caucus, and he worked on creating ACT UP Puerto Rico. But as his T cells were plummeting and AZT was not working for him, he felt that he had to, you know, get out of his comfort zone and enter into T&D, which was an all-white committee, treatment and data. And he got there, and after a few weeks, he realized that almost no one there was on AZT, that people had access to cutting-edge treatments. Most people had private insurance. Many people had really good doctors. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, this is, it's part of the legacy of ACT UP, is that the issue of access has always been a murky issue in ACT UP, and it remains the most murky element of AIDS today. Because although we were able to beat HIV, we could not beat capitalism. And so we have an unequal healthcare system nationally and globally, and that was true within ACT UP as well.
You also talk quite openly about the faults of Tony Fauci. We have all watched with bemusement as he has become the national hero. So illuminate for us a little about Tony Fauci.
Well, I handed in the manuscript before COVID, so it was before the second coming of Tony Fauci, you know, because there always has to be the white male hero. And so I really wasn't thinking about him when I wrote the book. Going back and rereading it, there's an inadvertent story about him that emerges, which is that every time someone in ACT UP had an innovation and went to Fauci, he said no. We see Richard Elovich, who was a leader of the needle exchange campaign, and he went to Fauci and said, how come you're not enrolling IV drug users in experimental drug trials? And Fauci said, well, they're not reliable. And Richard was like, no, you cannot write off an entire class of people. Linda Meredith, when it took the women over 2 years to finally get a meeting with the government. And when they went in there, she found Fauci to be completely uninterested in women with AIDS. Jim Igoe wrote a letter to Fauci laying out his concept for parallel track, and Fauci didn't answer. And 3 months later, Jim had to go to a public meeting where Fauci was speaking and confront him. So, you know, eventually Fauci did come around, but because we harassed him, I mean, we circled the NIH, people broke into his office, people put things in his files, you know, and he was forced to come around. But he was not the early hero of AIDS. There's even, I have 60 photographs in the book, many of which have never been seen before. And one is an ACT UP demonstration where someone's holding a sign saying, Fauci, you're killing us. But then later, there is a meeting when Fauci did come to the Gay and Lesbian Center, and we see him meeting with Mark Harrington and Larry and Peter Staley, et cetera, Suzanne Phillips, et cetera.
Now, it's an amazing array of characters, a very rich, diverse group of people. But you also quote activists we all know, Jamie Bauer, saying, remembering that a lot of men initially came to ACT UP because it was the first time in their life that white male privilege wasn't working for them. So what did people brought all different kinds of politics to ACT UP, didn't they?
Yes. And it's not just Jamie who said that. Rick Loftus said that. Charles King said that. Sharon Tramatola and Ann Northrup said that. That was a very widely held analysis by members of ACT UP. People can't, you know, the gay movement, as you well know, as foundational pioneers of this movement, did not come from nowhere. Many gay people were involved in previous movements, but they were expelled. The Communist Party kicked out gay people. The civil rights movement sidelined Bayard Rustin. The feminist movement had lesbian purges. So even though people came to the movement with enormous amounts of political experience, that was from other movements. In ACT UP, there were older men who had come from gay liberation. People like Bill Ballman and Marty Robinson and Vito Russo and Mark Rubin. But a lot of the younger men had never been politically active before. And so women who had enormous organizing experience, for example, Jamie Bauer came from the Women's Peace Movement and brought nonviolent civil disobedience trainings. Marion Bonsoff came from the Feminist Women's Health Movement. Maxine Wolf came from the Reproductive Rights Movement. And people brought in foundational ideas that really influenced ACT UP. And a lot of also members of the Latino Caucus came from anti-fascist movements in Latin America, the Mexico City Student Movement, et cetera.
Well, yes, and it was thrilling to be in those meetings, those Monday night meetings, and have those people stand up and bring that experience to the room and teach the younger men with HIV who were there to save their own lives about the larger issues and about strategy and tactics. But you talk about how the people in that room were people who were compelled to act.
Yes.
And I think we've all known, or some have, that there are only a finite number of people in this world who will act in those ways, who will be activists. And sometimes we bemoan the fact that more people don't do it. But in fact, there is a finite number. But this is the universe of people who feel compelled to act.
Yeah, so ACT UP was actually quite small, but it was extremely effective. The Monday night meetings were packed, but it's 300 to 700 people. Our largest demonstration stopped the church had 7,000 people. So that's not a mass movement. It's a vanguard movement. And, you know, over the 18 years that we interviewed Jim and I, one of our priority questions was, what do these people have in common? So when we started out, my assumption was that maybe they all came from backgrounds that were community-oriented. So if you analyze the interviews in the first 3 years, I'm asking a lot of people, like, did you go to church? Did your parents belong to PTA? Like, I'm trying to get it. And it took me absolutely nowhere. There was nothing that was consistent. Then we thought, well, maybe it's foundational experiences with AIDS. But that also was not true. People came to ACT UP who did not know anybody with AIDS. I mean, it's really, really interesting. Finally, in year eight, I interviewed this actress, Rebecca Cole, who had gotten, she was working in a bar, and she had gotten a job at this thing called the AIDS Hotline, which was this random thing. There was no information. There were no treatments. Nobody knew what caused AIDS. It was a bunch of actors working for $10 an hour who knew nothing. And a woman called on there from Connecticut saying she had AIDS and she had been turned down from an experimental trial because she was a woman. Now, the reason for this historically was that in the 1960s, there was a drug called thalidomide that was given to pregnant women and their children were born without limbs. And pharma had to pay out millions of dollars in settlements and they didn't want to ever do that again. So they banned women from experimental drug trials. Well, Rebecca thought that this was terrible, and she called the CDC, made an appointment, went with a friend of hers, and met with them. And this is the beginning of the history of the solidarity movement with women with HIV. And I was like, oh, this is not experiential. This is characteristic. This is a type of person who cannot stand there and be a bystander when there's a cataclysm.
Now, you have the
Go ahead, Andy.
You have the experience of taking United in Anger, your film, all over the world and helping influence people who want to start other movements. You can talk about that, but also how you want this book to be used. What are people going to get from this book?
Okay, so I think the main takeaways are that one of ACT UP's greatest strengths was that it was not a consensus-based movement. So it did not try to force everyone to agree on any analysis or strategy or anything. It had a one-line principle of unity, direct action to end the AIDS crisis. And that was direct action as opposed to social service provision. So if you were doing direct action to end the AIDS crisis, you could do anything you wanted. And if other people didn't want to do it, they just wouldn't do it. And you would find other people who wanted to do it. And that was one of ACT UP's great strengths. Another was Maxine Wolf used to say, theory will emerge from action, which is contrary to the left idea of praxis, right? Theory into action, where theory comes first. So her idea was that if you're doing an action, you have to make decisions about how to do it. And those decisions will make you cohere your values. And that's how your theory will emerge. So ACT UP did not have theoretical debates. There was no debate about theory that was not rooted in something real. And that's very helpful. Another thing that I think people can really learn from ACT UP is that women and people of color did not stop the action to do consciousness raising about sexism and racism. You could spend your whole life trying to change one person and fail. Instead, women and people of color marshaled ACT UP's substantial resources to get their own projects done. So when the Latino caucus realized that people in Puerto Rico needed help, they were funded by money that ACT UP had brought in to go to Puerto Rico and start ACT UP Puerto Rico. The women's campaign similarly. And a great deal of money was brought in. But interestingly, and this is another lesson, ACT UP never got a 501c3, never applied for grants. The money came from the community in many ways. There was a big art auction that was organized by Ann Philbin and Patrick Merla and Charles Hovland that raised $650,000. But also, just every time you were tabling or selling buttons, people would just hand whatever was in their wallet over to us. And, you know, it was a very much community supported.
The book is fantastic. It is 700 pages. We could do another 10 hours on it, but we need to wrap this up and get to other news at some point. So Let the Record Show is the book. I cannot stop recommending the ACT UP Oral History Project itself, which is online at actuporalhistory.org. The movie United in Anger, which I think is free online. People can see it on just Google United in Anger and find that. I just want to a couple other things. You have a couple of events with the New York Public Library coming up in June that people can be part of, June 5th and June 21st.
Tommy Anthony Appiah on June 21st.
We will link to all these things in our email. Sign up for our email.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
Onward
and upward.
I'm sorry I didn't turn my phone off. There's a controversy at the moment. You're a co-founder of the Lesbian Avengers, and the Gap ripped off the Lesbian Avengers T-shirt. Tell us what's up with that.
Well, when I first found out about it, I thought they had stolen it from us. But actually, two members of the Avengers licensed it to them without discussing it with the rest of the group.
Oh, ugly.
Yes, so a bunch of us met, and we have written a letter to our colleagues asking them to please get the Gap to stop this. Because I wrote a novel called The Mere Future, and in that novel, it's a futuristic thing, and the Gap has a campaign called Audre Lorde Wore Khakis. And it was not a joke, but now it's reality, and most of us in the Avengers do not want any licensing to the Gap.
Life imitates art. And one other thing, you are a longtime, very dedicated and well-known supporter of the Palestinian cause. As the world there is blowing up, can you give us a quick insight or reaction to what's going on there? It kind of feels like the world is at least feeling a little more sympathetic to Palestinians these days.
I mean, I think that the Israeli government is repeating what it's always been doing, which is trying to land grab. And it's settler colonialism, and it's like a kind of ethnic cleansing. And they're trying to kill or drive out Palestinians from inside Israel, from the West Bank, from Gaza, everywhere. But this time around, the world really cannot stand it. I would say most of the countries in the world are clearly horrified. And hopefully, and for the first time, we have people in Congress who are saying, no, the U.S. has to stop funding this murder. And hopefully we will be able to get to that point soon. Biden is really out of touch on this issue. He doesn't get it. And we're hoping that the rise of the public and of our government officials in opposition will be able to move the U.S. out.
Well, thank you for that work. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for this book. It is a triumph.
You did it.
Yay.
Cannot recommend it, really. And now on to the TV series, right?
Yes. Christine Vachon, who was a member of ACT UP and whose partner Marlene McCarty was the only woman in Grand Fury, has optioned the book for television with Jonathan King of Concordia, which made the Central Park 5 series. So we'll see. But that's where we are right now.
Okay. That'll be, we'll keep an eye on that. Thank you. Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And Christine
Vachon
also did the Pride series, and I watched the last three episodes, and one of them featured Ann Northrup. You did a great job, Ann.
Well, I was horrified at how I looked in the current interviews, but I was thrilled with how I looked younger. So,
so now, there we go. Now, if you think
they shot it before I lost 25 pounds, I begged them to reshoot, but that was
the Pride series is on Hulu. It was on FX, but it's on Hulu, so you can still watch it. And if you think, you know, we don't need activism, of course, we're going to tell you things going on all over the world, including here in the United States, where they are now basically declaring our Equality Act as dead in Congress. The House passed it. The Senate we'll take it up. Now, Schumer said he would have a vote on it, meaning a cloture vote. I don't even know if that's going to happen now, which we would lose. You know, Joe Manchin doesn't like the bill over trans issues. Susan Collins dropped off, the Republican, because HRC dropped her.
Not a surprise. It's not a surprise in this atmosphere where you can't get a single Republican vote when Mitch McConnell is against something, and you need 10 votes, and that's if you've got all the Democrats. It is just not a surprise.
If you don't need 10 Republican votes for appointments, that's changed. And Kristen Clark was Senate confirmed 51-48 with one Republican vote, Collins, the first black woman to lead the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. She had led the Civil Rights Bureau of New York AG's office, and she was head of the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights under the law. So a break.
She's terrific. People are very excited about her, and so are we, so that's great. Now, we have cut down our available time today by talking to Sarah for a long time, so we're going to zip through some of this. In Tennessee, the governor has signed the No Trans Youth Medical Care Pre-Puberty. I don't know what he thinks is happening pre-puberty, but anyway, he signed that. But the Nashville, Tennessee district attorney, Glenn Funk, has announced that he will not enforce the law we told you about last week, which requires businesses to post signs if they respect people's gender identity in using bathrooms.
So it says enforcement of transphobic or homophobic laws is contrary to our values, and we will not promote hate, he said.
And in Arkansas, where they passed a no medical care for trans youth bill, the ACLU and a bunch of clients, including parents, kids, and doctors, have filed the first lawsuit in the country against this current wave of these bills. And they promise to challenge every single one of these bills nationwide.
But the Alabama legislature closed up for shop for the year without advancing a bill to criminalize health care for trans youth.
Maybe the message is getting out.
But in West Virginia, a federal judge denied the state's move to dismiss Lambda's lawsuit versus their ban on gender-affirming care in the Medicaid and state employee health plans.
Yeah, that's a good thing. And maybe if we get better politicians, we can avoid some of this. In Lincoln, Nebraska, they elected new city council members, and three of them.
Top row, everybody but the black guy.
Yeah, Sandra Washington on the left is the first black lesbian elected to any job in Nebraska. And the third from the left, the white guy there with the plaid tie, he is the gay new chair of the city council. And the guy on the far right is also gay.
That's Tom Beckius. And, okay. All right.
In New York, we have a new nominee for the Court of Appeals, Tony Canatero, replacing the late and very lamented Paul Feinman, who was the first out gay person on the Court of Appeals, the highest court in New York, and he died suddenly at a very youthful age, and now Tony Canatero has been nominated to replace him.
Well, Tony served on about every court in the city, it seems, but he's also the co-chair of the Richard Fala LGBT Commission of the New York State Court, so he's active in the community.
And a married gay man. And then in bad politics in New York, dropping every second lower and lower mayoral candidate, Sean Donovan, has really put his foot in it. He cross-endorsed a candidate for the Bronx borough presidency, Fernando Cabrera. Tell us about Fernando, Andy.
Well, no, just that, I mean, he's an arch bigot, far-right fundamentalist who runs for a lot of offices. He was elected to the city council. But, I mean, you know, his views on gay people are basically genocidal.
Very. In Pennsylvania, disappointment with the legislature there, which refused it's Republican control. They have a Democratic governor, but the Republicans control the legislature, and they refused to support a bill that would have repealed the law that says it is obscene to mention homosexuality in books for minors. So that law remains on the books.
And, you know, the 60 Minutes piece, Leslie Stahl, they started it out on the pretext that they were covering these anti-trans laws, but then it just descended into a look at, oh, these people who have detransitioned or regret having transitioned. And, you know, they were just setting up propaganda for the right wing on it.
1% of people who have transitioned detransition, and the majority of them detransition because they have family and peer pressure. It's a tiny, tiny number of people who detransition because they simply change their minds. Leslie, I think, found all of those people. And in fact, she found them as members of a right-wing organization. But a couple of things. If you look at the piece online, the 60 Minutes piece, you will also see a 60 Minutes overtime piece. And if you look at that, you see her talking to Alfonso David of HRC and a lot of experts who say, don't do this piece. You will hurt trans people. It's criminal for you to do this piece. And yet they went right ahead and did it.
It's a long tradition at 60 Minutes.
They did a piece on Martina Navratilova decades ago where they called her straight. They interviewed her as a straight person.
Let's go back to New York City. We told you that the Heritage of Pride, which organizes the big parade on Pride Day but isn't doing one this year, decided not to have cops in uniform in the parade. Well, then they had a membership vote. That's 55-40% said, we want them back there in uniform. Immediately after the meeting, the executive committee, which I have learned is majority people of color, said, no, you know, we're not doing this. And it's complicated. This may change 5 times before next year, but that's where we are.
Yeah, so they're back to being mostly banned. Now they're telling the Gay Officers Action League that if they want to march not in uniform, not with their guns, which they would usually be carrying, then they might consider letting them in. Goal is pondering whether they want to do that.
And of course, Reclaim Pride for the Queer Liberation March, where we will be, also bans police in uniform. But we don't have to ban police in uniform because it's a demonstration. And police in uniform are not allowed to march in demonstrations, including their own union actions.
Hop is a mess at the moment.
Well, speaking of unions, the two new best friends in the world are now Chris Cooper and Anderson Cooper. They were very engaging in a conversation to benefit the Audubon Society, where Chris is on the board. They discussed race issues, coming out, and bird watching. It was really more Chris interviewing Anderson more than vice versa. And thanks for the plug, Chris, for Gay USA.
And it ended up with Anderson Cooper asking Chris Cooper to take him birding.
Yes.
We will await that report.
We want to be there with a camera.
Yeah. And now to the news of course, of violence. In Hopkinton, Mass., a very strange story, a young lesbian, Michaela Miller, 16 years old, was reported as having committed suicide after a fight with her ex-girlfriend. But now her family says no, she did not commit suicide, and she was found supposedly having hung herself, but she was basically standing next to a little sapling tree with a belt around her neck.
And that did not belong to her.
Did not belong to her and could not have been used to commit suicide in that situation.
Well, the National Black Justice Coalition is all over this, as is her family. And the DA says we will continue the investigation. But it was a quick rush to judgment from the police. And she was attacked by a whole group of other, I believe, girls right before.
Yeah, I'm not sure whether it was just girls or girls and boys, but yeah, she was attacked. And then in Gervais, Oregon, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, a young trans man, Ollie Taylor, 17 years old, was kidnapped in this strange situation and shot and died.
The person who abducted him, well, shot a whole bunch of other people afterwards, went on a killing spree. It was just horrendous. And there was gunshots with the police, but the gun that killed Ollie came from the perpetrator. In South Carolina, a 35-year-old trans person, Thomas Harden, was killed May 2nd. I'm sorry, this was the one, I apologize. This is the one that was part of a killing spree who also killed four others. Thomas identified as a woman, but used the name Thomas and had no preferred pronouns.
We also are mourning some deaths, not the result of murders, but people we've lost.
Yeah, Terry Riley was famous as a curator of architecture and design for 15 years at the Museum of Modern Art. He has died at the age of 66. I knew him because he was in ACT UP at one time. Sudden death, but not the cause was not disclosed. He supervised MoMA's major expansion that was completed in 2004. And at his death, he was director of the Perez Art Museum in Miami, and he guided the creation of a new home for them.
And one of the foundational lesbian leaders, Alex Dobkin, died at the age of 80 of a brain aneurysm and a stroke. She was a musician and author. She's famous for her album Lavender Jane Loves Women. And this is her memoir, My Red Blood. She was part of the folk music scene in Greenwich Village in New York.
She even played with a young Bill Cosby, but she also became Bob Dylan's favorite, quote, girl singer, unquote. She said there are only two responses to freedom. One is trying to control everything. The other is to be creative and take risks. And she was also, in her later life, co-director of Old Lesbians Organizing for Change, survived by a daughter and grandchildren.
Very famous in the lesbian community and toured all over women's music festivals, Europe. She was a columnist, really an important figure and much mourned these days.
Good.
In Pendleton, Indiana, three high school teachers were ordered to take down rainbow flags described by the school principal or whomever as political paraphernalia. The school also was not supporting the school GSA, calling it a sensitive topic that should not be brought up in the school.
Call the ACLU.
In Pittsburgh, they did a study published in the Journal of Pediatrics of over 3,000 high school students from 13 racially and economically diverse schools. And they asked these students what their sex at birth was, and then asked them whether they described themselves as boys, girls, trans, non-binary, genderqueer, some other definition. 9.2% of these kids were classified in the end as gender diverse. The universe is expanding of gender diverse younger people. And in Cobb County, Georgia, Pope High School will dead name a trans student at his graduation. He's a young trans man, and he's begged the school to use his, you know, lived in name at graduation. And they say, oh, no, we can only use your legal name, and you haven't changed your name yet.
Other students are standing up for him.
18,000 have signed a petition supporting him. And Media Matters warns that TikTok is pushing anti-LGBTQ content. All right. international news.
I did watch the documentary that we talked about last week about Peter Tatchell called Hating Peter Tatchell on Netflix, and I highly recommend it.
In Brazil, a beloved out-gay comedian, Paulo Gustavo, died of COVID at age 42. He had a drag persona as a loud suburban mom with of a gay son, universally mourned in the country, even by the homophobic president of Brazil.
In Japan, they they're having the Olympics, so they're trying to pass some kind of gay legislation, and they resisted. Well, they passed something, but all it says is that we want to promote greater awareness of sexual minorities. Discrimination is unacceptable, but they didn't make it illegal.
In both India and Namibia, they are delaying court consideration of legalizing same-sex marriage, mostly with COVID as an excuse. We'll keep an eye on that.
In Ghana, 21 LGBTQI people were arrested on May 20th in the city of Ho after a local tip-off. They were representatives of a civil society organization holding a session on protecting LGBTQI people from discrimination. And then they get charged with unlawful assembly. They're being held. They can be, you know, it's just, they're outrageous.
Well, in Bangkok, Thailand, they arrested three times as many, 62 men at a gay sauna, and were charged with sex and drug offenses. But basically, they're just rounding up gay people.
And in Singapore, the government warned the U.S. Embassy over its hosting of a webinar with the local LGBT support group, calling it interference in their internal homophobic affairs. They didn't use the word homophobic. Sex between men there is punishable by 2 years in prison.
Thanks to the former president of Ireland, Mary McAleese, who's very pro-LGBT, has a gay child. She says she regrets sending her kids to Catholic school.
And in Northern Ireland, the new leader of the right-wing DUP party is so horribly anti-gay and everything else that his party is plummeting in the polls. And Sinn Féin is now the number one party in Northern Ireland.
We should be tuning in to The Bachelorette Australia.
Yes.
Because Brooke Blurton is the new contestant, and she is bisexual and Indigenous, and there are going to be both male and female contestants on this edition of Bachelorette Australia. She previously appeared on The Australian Bachelor as a contestant herself and on Bachelor in Paradise.
Is that the first time they've ever mixed up the people vying for her affections?
They've mixed up people racially, but they have never mixed up people genderly.
Okay. In Iran, you know, in response to that gruesome murder of a 20-year-old gay man by his family, gay people are going out in Iran with rainbow flags and taking pictures of themselves and getting it posted on social media. It is a very daring and dangerous activity, but they are doing it.
Well, we have 5 minutes left, so we're in dangerous territory, too.
Okay.
Can we move on to AIDS news?
Okay. There's going to be a memorial for Larry Kramer on Thursday, May 27th at 7 p.m. at the New York City AIDS Memorial, 7th Avenue and West 12th Street. It is the one-year anniversary of his death. This is organized by ACT UP.
Good news from Illinois and Nevada. Illinois, the legislature has repealed their HIV criminalization law. That's a big deal, and the governor is expected to sign it. And in Nevada, the legislature has passed a modernization of their HIV criminal laws. No details yet that I know, but the governor, I think, will also sign that. And our friend Mike Rogers was rejected for donation of good blood for six sick kids because he's a sexually active gay man, even though he's HIV negative and has been monogamous for years.
Okay. Entertainment news.
Yeah.
Disgraced actor Kevin Spacey, 61, is going to be in a movie starring Vanessa Redgrave.
A small Franco Nero.
Cameo as a police detective.
Yeah. Legos has come out with rainbow Legos for Pride. I don't really care.
But the gayest thing of the week has to have been Lil Nas X's performance of his hit Montero, Call Me By Your Name, on Saturday Night Live, replete with wardrobe malfunction, lots of bare chests and crotch grabbing, neck licking. It was the most homoerotic thing I've ever seen on that show.
He's holding his pants because they split.
Yeah.
They also did a pride song, which I thought fell a little flat, but it ended with everybody discouraged about being on a corporate float at the Pride Parade.
There's a new documentary coming out June 1st on iTunes and Amazon, Julia Scotti, funny that way, about the transition of comedian Julia Scotti. Someone who came out later in life. She made a splash on America's Got Talent, but the larger story is about her relationships, including with her adult children.
That's interesting. We haven't seen, but heard recommended something on Netflix, Dance of the 41. It's the true story of the arrest of 42 men at a party in Mexico City 100 years ago. But one of them was the son-in-law of the president, so he got disappeared from the arrestees. So it became 41, and 41, it turns out, is a stigmatized number because of that in Mexico. There often are buildings with no 41st floor, and people don't celebrate their 41st birthdays, and the Army does not have a 41st battalion, all because of this story. So Dance of the 41 on Netflix, recommended.
90 Day Fiancé on TLC, the first gay male couple on the show, Armando Rubio and Kenneth Niedermeyer. They got married in Baja California, in Mexico. Both their kids were on hand, and they met through a gay dad support group. And June 1st is LGBTQ Families Day.
Currently running on HBO, Pause with Sam Jay, black lesbian comedian. It's very raw, but interesting, a series, Pause with Sam Jay. And PBS American Masters, June 4th, Ballerina Boys, about the ballet Trocadero de Monte Carlo, described by one viewer as compelling, funny, heartfelt, heartbreaking, inspiring.
And in the United Kingdom, 18 theaters have signed a pledge, including the Royal Court Theater there in London, to cast only trans actors in trans roles.
And Tom Jones, who wrote The Fantastics, has written a new gay version at the request of a theater in Detroit, and it will play there in December.
Oh, boy. We're down to 36 seconds. I remember our friend, Edward Albee, would never allow gay versions of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Well, we'll see how this turns out. Thank you all for watching Let the Record Show by Sarah Schulman. You will not be sorry. And we will see you next week.
Thank you.